I'm joined today by Robert Hurlbut, a software and security consultant working in the Boston area. Thanks for joining me, Robert.
Thank you.
Can you tell me a little bit about your background, please?
Yes, I have been in working in software for a number of years. Started out years ago in working in C, C++ in the early days, and then as time went on, moved into eventually into .NET and some Java. And the last 12 years, 15 years, something like that, and mostly on the Microsoft side, .NET and so forth, and also a lot of web application development for companies.
Was there a particular reason that you chose to focus on security?
Yes, about a little over 10 years ago, I was working at a company, and it was actually around the time that I started my own independent consulting business. And I noticed that working with other developers and just looking at the industry itself, that there was a need for developers to know more about developer security, software security. And so I became more and more interested in that. I started learning more, started writing a blog. I started speaking at some code camps. Boston Code Camp actually was one of the first places I spoke at, as well as some user groups, and then other national conferences. And so it kind of went from there. That's kind of where I started. And again, my main interest was just helping other developers to understand more about software security.
Do you think that's something that a lot of developers neglect?
I do. I think that there are various reasons for that. One is time. It's somebody else's job. It's too difficult. So therefore, it doesn't get done, or I'm in a rush. I don't have time to build this in. The other thing is, I think that sometimes in various companies and situations, it may not be a priority. The budget may not be there. Security is one of those things that if you don't think of it and budget for it on the front end, it's going to be much more difficult, if not nearly impossible, to build it in after the fact. Although you do hear companies say, "Well, now we've got everything done. Now let's build security back in." And it doesn't work that way. You've got to think about it on the front end. So I think there are a combination of those things that why it can be difficult, or that developers or companies don't think about security.
But do you think that some of the frameworks are have some responsibility? Like at one of your presentations, I remember you talking about MVC right out of the box, no security.
Well, in some cases, yes. I know that let's talk about MVC from Microsoft for .NET. In that environment, it's improved over the years in that particular framework. For example, some of the earlier versions, XSS or cross-site scripting was more prevalent. And then as they went along in their versions, especially with the Razor templates and being able to write up views, some of that was sort of finally built in, so you didn't have to use external libraries, the anti-XSS library, for example. Because of some conventions that you use, it's now built in. So certainly frameworks are helping that, but it's not foolproof and it's not complete. There are still some things that you need to know. But yeah, I agree that I think there are some necessary things that the framework should build in, but they can't build in everything because they also have to be flexible enough for the various environments that you're trying to build.
So if you were building a Microsoft MVC website, what would you do as first steps for putting proper security in?
Well, I would look at the access control and make sure that there are a couple things that you can look at. For example, an unauthorized filter or attribute on your controller, and making sure that's in place. You can also use that in a global way for adding to your filters this attribute. Also, you can use anonymous for certain actions. So by default, all controllers should have an authorize attribute on the controller itself for access control, and then determine what you want to open up. So by default, everything should be secure, locked down. The other thing is, again, making sure that XSS is dealt with on the OWASP top 10. XSS is still one of the top issues. And even though, as I mentioned, MVC, the current MVC framework seems to handle this fairly well, it's still possible based on some external JavaScript libraries you might bring in. So you have to think about that, about your attack surface. And then also CSRF, cross-site request forgery. You'll be aware of the various patterns that you can use for dealing with that particular vulnerability. And then also model binding, making sure that you are checking your models and what you're posting back, that there are no issues with putting in extra properties that you may not want to be set, let's say maliciously by an attacker that can then just simply model, you know, bind your model to a database or something and inadvertently reset values, which essentially is a form of parameter tampering. So those are some initial things that I think of and look at when I'm building an MVC site.
With something like filters and attributes and then delegating handlers, can you talk a little bit about those ones?
Some of these, for example, the filters and delegating handlers allow you to, on a more global level, handle some of these issues. One of the other things, and in that presentation that you were in, I also had some questions about Web API. There's two versions, Web API 1 and 2. A lot of the things that apply to MVC also apply to Web API 1. In Web API 2, it's very interesting. It's a little bit different style, if you will, or direction, rather, where Microsoft is implementing an OWEN specification, the Open Web Interface, and their implementation of that is Katana, which essentially is all about security, actually. It's taking you away from relying on system web, having a lightweight framework, and then also being able to better utilize token authentication and authorization, as opposed to everything being in the cookie, which was, of course, the system.web implementation. So those are some things that come into play with, for example, Web API 2 that are nice. And so when you have that in place, things like CSRF actually are less of an issue because one of the things about CSRF is the cross-site script request forgery is that you need to make sure that you have some kind of authentication, usually based on a cookie, implicit browser authentication, which you see with JavaScript and so forth, so that if I'm in a session, I can, let's say, open another tab and be able to attack using that same session and writing that session and be able to hit that person's website, and a user may not even realize it, that, you know, because I'm going to an attacker site, there I'm clicking a button, but that in turn is then calling my site, writing on my session. So a lot of things to be aware of, and like I said, there are some things that are mitigating that. For example, the Web API too.
Would you recommend that a whole website goes under SSL, or just the parts that need to be?
Well, if you're going to use SSL or HTTPS, you really need to put the whole site under HTTPS. There's an interesting YouTube video by Troy Hunt. I think it's about a 10-minute video that shows what happens if you have part of your site under HTTPS, for example, logging in And then once you're authenticated, run the entire, or rest of the site rather, as HTTP. That if you do that, he shows how he can install a JavaScript keylogger after you're authenticated on the session, and then being able to grab all your keys. This is something you want to prevent against. You want to run the entire site under HTTPS, ideally.
In the scenario where you have, let's say, your secure login and you get your cookie, and then you're switching to insecure, I presume your cookie is transiting into clear at that point and could easily
Correct.
Be grabbed.
Yeah, and that's the problem, yes.
And Amazon, though, from what I recall, you'll log in, it will be secure, but as you browse, I think a lot of it is just plain old HTTP.
I don't think so for Amazon. I know at one time, for example, Facebook used to do that. But now they're 100% HTTPS. I'm not 100% sure on Amazon.
I have it open, actually, and as you browse books.
Interesting.
It is. And I even have this add-on called HTTPS Everywhere, which would attempt to force a HTTPS connection if it was possible, but it's not there for Amazon. As you go to your cart, it becomes there.
It does become there, and then you do have to re-authenticate. I do know that.
If you've just been kind of pottering around for a while and you haven't.
Right. So that's interesting. And it may be that they, I'd have to check. It may be that they are, once you are done with the authenticated session, they log you out, essentially. Although you're not logged out, obviously. They still recognize you from your cookie.
I'd have to check at that. Would they do that with having multiple cookies, like a cookie that just knows who you are as opposed to a cookie that knows you're really logged in?
Correct, yes. I would think they would do that. An identification, simply here's your name versus actually authenticated to, which is why they ask you the second time to authenticate before you do any kind of sensitive transaction.
Do you think that over the last number of years, Microsoft has been improving the quality of the security?
Oh, yeah, definitely. There was a big push for the trustworthy computing a few years ago as a result of a memo from Bill Gates that, we need to really take security seriously. And as a result, there's been a great improvement across the board.
Was this just purely a matter of investment or hiring or a bit of everything?
A little bit of everything, as I recall. I know there are some changes lately that have been happening, but I know certainly at that time there was an emphasis across the board to do a little bit better job in on the OS and so forth. I'm not saying they got everything right, but certainly there were things that came out of that. For example, threat modeling. There is the Stride, the other methods of doing threat modeling that came out of Microsoft, and actually they have probably one of the most comprehensive ways of doing threat modeling, and there are a lot of companies that have looked at them and as a model for that, as an example. So, and then of course secure SDLC and so forth. So I think they did a lot of things. There are a lot of people that complain and so forth still. And they are one of the number one targets out there. But I think they've made a lot of great strides as a result of their emphasis.
But I suppose if we look at the more recent issues with Heartbleed and Shellshock, Microsoft has been pretty immune to those.
Yes. Overall, yes. And actually, the interesting thing about some of those issues are, I think it goes back to once again, thinking about design. Lately, I've been kind of pointing to this new IIIE report in their cybersecurity design division, I guess that's what you'd call it, a report that came out, the top 10 security design flaws, and where they're trying to point to not to just the bugs, because we talk all about the bugs, that's always a big deal. But really about going back to the design, thinking about your initial design when you're design when you're putting together your software and thinking about how do I deal with user input? How do I deal with who am I trusting? What am I trusting? And so on. Before you even touch the software, and letting that then drive how you build the software, as opposed to trying to figure out, okay, now I've got a problem. Now I need to go fix a bug. By that time, it's almost too late. It's harder to go back and redesign the way that your software works. And so I think some of those, in fact, I know that some of those issues that you just mentioned can relate back to some issues with design, certainly Heartbleed with some potential overflow problems. That's a design problem, you know, and so those are things that may have been mitigated or could have been mitigated much earlier on with a different design.
Or maybe even better testing.
Or testing, certainly. But that's also part of, the whole software life cycle, development life cycle.
But I suppose one of the things is, in the past, it was assumed that because it was open source, anyone could go and look at it and there'd be many, many eyes on it. But I think from what I remember with Heartbleed, it was a piece of code that was changed by one person and checked by one other. And for all we know, that's really all the people that ever looked at it from a really serious critical point of view. And it raises the question of, is open source any more secure than anything else? And I'm inclined to say no, but what do you think from your experience?
Well, I'm also inclined to say no, not as much as any other software. It really depends. It depends on those who are writing the software and what kind of methods are they using for design, what kind of methods are they using for testing, what kinds of methods are they using for vetting new improvements or additions to the source code. I mean, it's the same issues that we have in any software. But just because, I mean, I guess another kind of an aside, but for example, I know one of the things from the Microsoft side right now is NuGet. And NuGet's a wonderful tool. It's great to be able to add things or add libraries and so forth. But at the same time, anytime you're adding these new libraries, the space that you are exposing potentially with more and more libraries that you've added that are not trusted or tested yet, you have no idea what's in there. So just because it's out on NuGet or just because it's out in open source or wherever does not necessarily mean that you're going to be completely safe. So you have to test that code just as much as you test your own code. As you go through fuzz testing and other kinds of testing, you have to use the same kinds of methods to verify that there's some reliability, not in just your code, but also the third-party code that you're using.
That's what I suppose I found very surprising, was that there are a lot of very big-name companies making, let's say, hardware firewalls that used to include some of the libraries that were affected by Heartbleed. And what it meant was that they uncritically accepted that this open-source community was providing code that was going to be robust enough for them, and they said, that's it, wash their hands of it and install it. Do you see that approach changing, or is that going to just continue because it's easy?
Well, at the moment, it's difficult to say. Although I will say, from what I'm hearing and seeing, that probably 2014, as we near towards the end, is going to be the year that they're saying cybersecurity finally became serious. Or at least we're getting more serious about it. We're certainly talking about it more. I mean, there's a lot of news stories about breaches and other kinds of issues and the Heartbleed and the shell shock and so forth that nearly every day we're hearing. So it's become more in the forefront. To answer the question, are we now going to be better at it? It remains to be seen. But if anything, we're talking about it, and that's the first step. Is that we're not just saying, oh, that affects everybody else and not me. The first step is to realize that we are also in this, and as an individual or a small company or a big company or anybody, that we all have to be aware of these issues and deal with them in the choices that we make.
For applications that are exposed to the web, do you think that the choice of C and C++ are still good ideas, given how many buffer overflow issues we've seen over the years?
Well, I would say probably err on the side of much like a few of my colleagues that no, unless you're really, really good at it and careful. But even then, it's really, really tough to do. It's really tough to avoid those issues. And there are some good tools. And I can remember years ago dealing with some of the memory checker tools and so on. But for, they used to say that the most high performant and embedded system type of work were the ones, the types of environments that you'd use a C and C++ or anything that need to be extremely fast. But we're at a place where certainly for business applications, there's really no need. I mean, we have managed code to handle some of those issues. We have fast processors. We have multiprocessors. We have lots of memory, lots of resources overall. And so, to drop back into those waters, if we have to, I mean, we don't really have to, I guess, is the answer. So it depends, as everything else, it depends. But I think for the most part, the managed code options are the better way to go for most development. And then most developers will say the same.
Within your own work, what are the typical weaknesses you see in companies?
Well, again, I think it's developer understanding of security in general. There's also that, the other thing I see is some companies or developers within the company may think our company is a small fish in the big pond, so who cares? What difference does it make if I circumvent a few things and do this the quick way, because I'm not Microsoft, I'm not some other big company, so I can get away with things. The problem is with that thinking is that actually many attacks can happen simply because your site or your website, your server, your application can be used as a jumping point to be able to attack other companies. And that's happened many times where the small fish has actually become the jumping point. And if everyone had treated this, I guess, more seriously, then you take away that potential threat or at least minimize it. And so I think that would be one of the major weaknesses is just that understanding or that thought, I'm the small fish, who cares what I do? That's also true about passwords. They are saying these days, for example, in handling passwords and handling other kinds of data issues, the majority of users use the same password across all their accounts. And so the small company, the small bank, the small whatever website says, what difference does it make how I authenticate users or how I store that password? Because I'm the small fish. I have 10,000 users. I don't have hundreds of thousands of users. What difference does it make? Or I have 500 users. But the problem is that my little database with very easy to hack passwords, those passwords, those emails could also be used elsewhere at the bigger places, because people normally use or some variation of the same password elsewhere. So if you think of it this way, we're all in the same business. We're all in the same team, if you will. So we all have a responsibility to do the very best we can to make our system secure, our data secure, and that helps not just us and our company and our small project, but also other companies and protecting users' data and so on.
When you're engaged by a company, how do you review their system for security?
Well, mostly what I've done, what I do is software on the software side. So I've reviewed threat modeling. So there are threat models to see if they actually have a threat model, if they're keeping it up to date, if they know where the data inputs, outputs are, which are typically the weak points of where an attacker can get in. And then also sometimes do some code reviewing, for example, if it's a web application, there are certain things to look for, certain types of attacks that could happen, so I know what to look for in that code. If it's other kinds of applications, I may run some fuzz testing tools, which essentially puts in many, many different kinds of valid or invalid inputs and then verify the outputs, and from that you can determine vulnerabilities. So there's some nice tools that do that, which are called fuzz testing tools. So those are a few of the things that I do just to help a company basically get a profile. Here's what we see. Here are some suggestions or recommendations, and then see what happens for the next step. Whether they make the fixes and we recheck it, or I make the fixes in some cases and verify that that we're in better shape.
Do you end up working with a company because of, let's say, they've had a security incident, or is it that they're maybe trying to improve, or it might be a regulatory issue?
For the most part, in my own experience, and I know others have, it just varies, but in mine, it's fortunately on most, it's because of they're at an early spot, an early time where they want to be assured that they're going to be secure when they go live. So I've had opportunities to help companies with products that have not yet gone live, but I've also helped with products that are live. An incident has not happened, fortunately. But yet they still want a review to evaluate, are we okay here? And I've gone in and evaluated and then also helped fix some issues.
Have you ever worked in the device space, like medical devices or other such things?
Not directly, but I do. One of my my customers is, I do some software on medical software, so I'm very aware of some of the issues with that. Although I have been very interested in lately in medical and healthcare security, there are lots of, actually it's a very interesting field, because it's one of those fields that, from what I understand, there's a lot of attention on locking down computers, laptops, and so forth, because, of course, personal health care information, making sure those are secure, but not much attention to some of the device security. In fact, there are a lot of devices that have no safeguards in place for anything like viruses or other kinds of malware. And in fact, there are several reports out there of some malware that the industry has known about for 6 years, for example, that they're still finding in hospitals in devices simply because there is very limited malware protection, and mainly because of the devices being with very limited resources. How do you put a virus checker onto a device, a medical device, a small medical device, that first of all needs to be updated regularly, and second of all, you need a full blacklist? The suggestion, the recommendation is, instead of using blacklist, use a whitelist. You know, look for what's right rather than what's wrong. But typically, virus checkers, malware checkers are not, that's not how they work. They usually update with all the bad stuff that you need to look for. So those are kinds of interesting things to me, that it's an interesting field ripe for help. certainly some thoughts about solutions to those issues.
How does a virus get onto one of these devices in the first place?
Well, basically in a very similar way that others, if your system has no firewall, if the device makes a call, trusting a file, running a file, or importing a file, and that file then changing the characteristics of the application, all kinds of things like that could happen. And plus the other thing is, a lot of these devices were never, going back to design again, never necessarily thought of, why in the world would anyone want to try to hack a device? So therefore, security, when I read in input from a file, I trust that file. I don't think anybody's ever going to manipulate that file to do something different than what I expect.
So no validation of the code.
Yeah, no real validation and so forth. And that may be, that particular characterization may be overstating it, but that's in a nutshell. That's essentially why a lot of these things were just never thought of when they were originally designed, and certainly in that particular space, the healthcare space, the attacks that are happening, actually recently have happened, where medical records were stolen. Protections of those kinds of records were just not there because, again, when they were originally designed, it was never thought as an avenue of how to get in through, for example, devices and so forth. That was just never thought that kind of thing could potentially or possibly ever happen, and now here we are. So that's really, in a nutshell, why those kinds of things can happen is because from way back when, those kinds of secure design thoughts were not, it was just not part of it, because we thought, well, how in the world would anybody ever do that? Why would they do that?
I have a friend who works in the medical record industry, and she told me that all the hospitals, even in Boston, they all have slightly different formats for their files, and they're all holding on to them from 10, 15 years ago. So then you end up with, I imagine, a lot of very custom coding and maybe non-standard databases, which are hard to keep maintain, hard to upgrade. You might even be afraid to upgrade them, or even patch your system when you have something fragile like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But then more recently, though, I was mentioning to you earlier about Barnaby Jack, a well-known hacker. He had a number of exploits, which you can find on YouTube. One was where, I think, called jackpotting, where he bought two ATMs, put in debugger boards, reverse engineered a lot of the code, found default passwords, and then was able to remotely, or if he had physical access to a real ATM, if he had physical access, he could put in a USB disk and install code. And otherwise, if he had remote access, he could install code and set it up so that he could pull money out of the machines. But a big part of what he was saying the problem was legacy Windows, I think CE. Was that a version of Windows that would have been common for embedded systems?
Yes, right. Yes, C.
And is that still a common system that's in use?
Yes. Yeah, it's still typical, yes.
And is it as secure as it ever was? or have they improved this?
No, not really. I mean, again, it's really, really, really hard to make that secure in the sense of memory issues and so forth. So can it be? Yes. But is it easy? No. It's very, very difficult. And it's very difficult also to find issues. I mean, we're still seeing that. We're still seeing, you know, even today, in issues that encode, for example, the Heartbleed has been around for a couple of years. And only this year was it found by some researchers. And it was something there in the code, and it was in the C code, C++ code, that could have been found, maybe, but it was difficult to see it from what I've seen in the snippet of code. So it's still something that's not, you know, so for me to say, is there a way to write secure C code? Yes and no, if that makes any sense, that you can by being careful, but it's also really, really difficult to do, mainly because of the memory issues that you can accidentally you know, stumble upon and introduce into your code.
And again, going back to the Barnaby Jack, he had also figured out a way of hacking an insulin pump remotely, wirelessly, and he was able to override its safeguards and inject a dummy with enough insulin to kill a person. And I was just reading that he had also figured out how to do certain things to pacemakers and heart implants. If Windows CE, for example, is a bad operating system potentially for embedded devices, and if C and C++ are the wrong choices for these kind of life critical things, where do we go to produce a insulin pump that's secure, relatively easy to build, that you can write software for and will be safe?
Well, that I'm not, you know, that I would say, I mean, there's still a place for embedded programming in C++. I'm not saying that there's not, and as I mentioned before, it depends. Those are still places where you may have to continue to use those kind of environments and frameworks, only because of resources and constraints. The thing about managed code in some cases is that you need to have the resources, the allowance of time and so forth for being able to dynamically compile your code and run it and so forth. Whereas in medical devices and other kinds of devices that need the split second or less time for a response, you need something that runs extremely fast, which means you need something that's going to run near as close as possible to the metal, if you will. And that is what C does for you, a step or two above assembly language. So it's not to say that you can't throw those away completely, but you do have to be more and more aware of the potential issues. And I think maybe outside of that, tools, other kinds of design thoughts about how to fuzz test these devices and so on is going to help. Because actually it was how Heartbleed was found, was through fuzz testing, if I remember correctly, by simply throwing different results and seeing the response, and then in so doing found the actual bug. So, you know, very extensive testing is going to help with those kinds of applications, I think, as well.
If there's a company out there and they think they have, you know, potential security issues and they want to engage someone to help them, how do they find someone who's good or qualified?
Well, one of the things you should look for is certainly somebody who has an understanding of software issues as well as security issues, of course. I know for myself recently, I did get the certification CSSLP, which is a Certified Secure Software Lifecycle Professional from the ISC Squared organization. And all that really means is that I understand, and anyone who has that particular certification understands, the secure development lifecycle, and you're tested accordingly. But also with that certification, you had to have been in the industry at least 4 years working in security. So that particular certification is some indicator that they not only have some knowledge, but also have some background. Now, that's just one of the types of certifications. And a certification doesn't mean everything, but the key is you're looking for someone who has knowledge, you're looking for someone who has some experience, you're looking for someone who is trying to understand what's out there. Looking for those types of people, you know, certainly LinkedIn is good. I think that's a great tool. And then also sometimes just word of mouth as well, knowing different people. Blogs are good. Twitter is good. There are certainly some good security researchers out there and other workers who have a passion for security and making sure that not only are they writing good secure software, but they also want to make sure other people are writing good secure software. As I mentioned to you, Troy Hunt is one that comes to mind who is doing a great job. So, you know, there are many, many different ways to find people, but I think those are some of the key things is proven experience, passion for it, and, you know, working on the right side of the whole scenario, that they're actually wanting to make your software secure. You know, they want to know when they go to sleep at night that what they've written is working well, secure, and is helping their customer to do the same.
Are there some trade shows that you'd recommend for in your industry?
Well, certainly the B-Sides, there's some security conferences that they continue to have across the country. There's the OWASP, that particular organization has some security conferences that they have in various places. New York and Boston actually is, there's going to be one this coming Saturday that meets once a year in Cambridge. Let's see, others, of course, there are different security cons. There's Black Hat, there's...
it was DEF CON.
DEF CON, there's the RSA security conference each year. There's several like that are good to attend, to learn things, but also, of course, to network with others who are in the industry that you may be able to get some good insights or some consulting help or advisement and so forth, I think are good recommendations as well.
And then for books, if you just wanted to learn some of it by yourself, what would you recommend?
Well, yeah, there are several out there that I like and I've read and enjoy reading. But my latest one, actually, I'd like to mention is Ironclad Java, Building Secure Web Applications. This is by Jim Manico and August Detlefsen. I hope I said it right. But these guys have written a top-notch book. It's probably one of the best I've read in a while. Very, very comprehensive for web security. Now, my background is mostly Microsoft. I've also done some Java work, and I ever so often I look at see what's going on the Java side and get up to date and so forth. And I saw this recently, and I've been reading it, and there's some really, really good stuff in there. For example, some of the CSRF recommendations on how to deal with that are you know, some of the best I've seen, and the treatment of that is some of the best I've seen. So some very platform neutral information there. So that's one I've been recommending lately. And I did actually just last week at a group I was speaking to, I recommended this book as well. So that's one I like at the moment.
So it's not just for Java. You say there's plenty for
everyone. Some Java specific things, but there's also, like I said, very platform neutral. If you're doing anything on web, it's definitely worth a read.
What about the Writing Secure Code book? I think it's Microsoft Press. I've heard a lot of people mention that one.
Absolutely. That's still a good one to look at, especially if you're on the Microsoft side or any C++ side. That was Michael Howard. It still applies. It's a few years old now.
It's 2002, yeah.
Yeah, but it still applies. I mean, there are a lot of concepts. Another one I'd recommend is Building Security In, which is the founders of Sigital. If you want to take a look at that one, Gary McGraw wrote that book a few years ago. But again, that's one of the first books that came out to talk about software security and really thinking about secure design and from the ground up. And that one's also another one I'd highly recommend is to getting a good foundation as well.
One of the things you often read when you're, if I was reading up something on, let's say, salting and hashing a password is, you know, don't do your own security, take the best practices and incorporate those. But is there a point, where do you reach a point when a person should feel comfortable to write their own type of thing? Or is it, you should always leave it to the framework writers at Microsoft?
So the question is, when would you write your own versus...
Yeah, sorry, I didn't state it very clearly. So you'll often come across a statement that you should never roll your own security. You should always use something provided by the professional, be it Microsoft or whoever's maintaining Java. But is there ever a point where, as an individual developer, you should take on that responsibility?
Well, here's where I think they say that mostly is cryptography. And actually, that's a good example where cryptography is one of those things that's really, really hard to get right. And there are a lot of people who think to themselves, hey, I could do this. I could figure out a good algorithm. I could figure out, a bigger key or whatever. And they'll try to roll their own. And that's definitely one of the areas where often it's said, don't roll your own. Use what's out there. In fact, for cryptography, it's always better to use a well-known and well-tested algorithm versus writing your own because you're never going to get it right. You're never going to get it as well as those who have spent years trying to perfect the algorithm. And really, you're only as secure as the size of the key in terms of how long it's going to take to break it. We have several algorithms with keys that are now considered not to be secure anymore, only because our computing power has gotten better. So those algorithms and keys that we're using today, in 10 years, we may not be. Only because our computing power, if the estimates continue, will get better and better. So that's a prime example of where it's not a good idea to roll your own and to look instead of to what's already been built and followed specs and so forth. It's hard for me to say, things that you might necessarily roll your own, other than understanding how the spec works and following it and understanding where the spec comes from. A prime example of that is some of the work that ThinkTexture is doing right now in building some of their work on OpenID Connect, OAuth2. They're taking the specs, they're going through and building out a system But at the same time, they will be the first to admit to you, this is really hard work, and they've spent a long time trying to get it right. So it's not for the faint of heart. To answer your question succinctly, I would say there's a reason why some of these things are in the framework, and they are, the patterns that they follow is because they're tried and true, they've been tested, they've been verified. And there's a reason why you don't want to roll your own, because the thing is really hard to do.
No, it's always funny. I have worked in one company where I came across someone who decided to write their own encryption. And immediately I noticed they had a statically hard-coded initialization vector. And that was, that was the end of that. I threw it out as soon as I could.
I bet, yes.
And one final thing, are you presenting at any upcoming events in the Boston area?
Yes, I am. Actually, on November 22nd, there is the Boston Code Camp. And it's kind of funny, I was at, I believe it started the second Boston Code Camp. This one is the 22nd Boston Code Camp. I haven't spoken in a few years at a Code Camp, but I'm going to be speaking at this one. And at this one, I'll be speaking with Bob Goodall. We are doing a kind of a tag team. It's a AngularJS MVC5 Web API 2 mini SPA application that we're putting together. He will be presenting on how to build one, or one that he's put together, and what it took to do it. And then I'll be taking the second part of that and telling folks how to secure it. What do you do to make sure you have secure authentication, authorization, and a few other issues that you may need to deal with when you introduce all these technologies into one application? So that should be fun to do. We've been learning a lot about that, and looking forward to presenting it.
It's a great event. I've been to a few of them in the last couple of years.
Well, yeah,
Robert,
they're great.
Thank you very much for your time this evening.
Thank you.
The opening music, as always, is The Return by Nisi23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music is Snowing by Peter Rudenko from the album 15 Etudes.